Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Jeanette Parker. I'm with Medical Whistleblower, and we're coming to you live from Lawrence, Kansas. We have a very interesting show for you today to highlight the way in which Medical Whistleblower is concerned about human rights. And we will be looking at a particular case that is happening now down in Texas. That is the case of a doctor, a plastic surgeon, who is currently being held in a jail in Houston, Texas. He is a plastic surgeon, and with us today we have his wife of many years, Sue Jacquarin, and also a civil rights court watcher, Ken Townsend, who is from Western Texas and has been watching this case. And I have both on the line right now. Sue, are you with us?
I'm here.
Okay. And Ken, are you also on the line?
Good morning, Miss Dr. Parker.
Okay. Well, I'd like to start off with a little introduction to our concerns for the human rights issues here, if you can all kind of bear with me. There are certain requirements, human rights requirements, for how persons should be treated when they are incarcerated or under a legal proceeding. And laws delineate how persons should be treated. And these laws come into play both from a local perspective, a state perspective, a federal perspective, and also an international perspective. I know that Ken's area of expertise is civil law, and so his area of watching this case has been under the auspices of the federal U.S. Constitution and the rights to due process and proper treatment of prisoners under that particular laws. And there is also, of course, a Texas Constitution and a Texas Bill of Rights, which also comes into play. That would be civil law. But there is also a 1966 International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which enshrines judicial rights as a matter of law, not just principle. And they include the right of every human being to a fair trial, immunity from arbitrary arrest, and immunity from retroactive sentencing. And there is a covenant and two optional protocols, which along with the 1966 Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which makes up the five-part document known as the International Bill of Human Rights. Many American citizens don't recognize that all of our judges in the United States are also required to be in concert with the international law as well as the U.S. constitutional law. And so any judge in the state of Texas is required to be knowledgeable about the law in his own state and his own locality. But he is also expected to understand his obligations under international law. And under international law, there is due process, rules and routines for fair treatment of suspects of wrongdoing, and there is information in regards to corruption and abuse of power. We are going to now go live to Sue Jacquarin, who's going to give us a little background about her husband. Sue, are you there?
I'm here.
So, Sue, you have been married to Dr. Jacquarin for how long?
Since 1975.
And is a good husband and father. You have two children?
Yes, we have two children. Our son, who just got married back in May of this year, mm-hmm. and we have a daughter. She is in her second year medical school. I guess she wants to be like her dad. And, you know, they're wonderful children, and Jacques has been great, great, great husband and a wonderful dad, you know. He worked very hard for all three of us, and not just three of us, it's for everybody else. And, you know, if anybody will know about his background, where he came from, it's really fascinating life that he had, you know. And
yeah, he started off in not this country. He originally came from Guyana, did he not?
Guyana, right. It's a country right next door to Brazil.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's the only country that spoke English, because his great-great parents came from India, and they came but when the country was under the British rule. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, the people that came to the country, they were working in a sugar cane, and that's what his parents did. But growing up in that environment, Jacques was too smart, you know. He just didn't want to be just a laborer. So he really worked very hard, and his parents had, I don't know, 12 children. I don't even remember exactly how many children they had. But they just couldn't afford to have, you know, to feed all the children. So he ended up living with relative in a barn, you know, basically to work and be able to feed himself and go to school. But when he finished high school, I mean, some years the kids used to go to school barefoot. The parents didn't even have, you know, money to provide them with shoes. So, I mean, not even food. So they had to work for themselves, and by the time he finished high school, he was able to teach the next class graduating after him. So he saved enough money, and his mother, you know, pawned her jewelry so he could buy a one-way ticket to England to go to college over there.
So his family really did feel that education was a very important part of life, and a way to move out of the poverty that he was originally born into.
He's the only one was educated out of the entire family,
mm-hmm.
you know, but he just thought, you know, this is not what I want. I don't want to be just a laborer. I want to be somebody, you know, and especially, you know, because they are Indian origin, they always, you know, the white people, the British, they always look down on them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he felt like he was just like a slave, you know. He's not equal with the white man.
So because he was a man of color, he experienced some discrimination in trying to pursue his goals.
Exactly, yeah. And so he just, you know, worked very hard, saved enough money, and his mother, you know, was so nice. You know, she loved him, you know, very much, and she knew he had potential. You know, he cannot be just high school graduate. He wanted to be somebody. So, you know, she had some jewelry. She pawned her jewelry and gave him the money so he could buy a one-way ticket to England. When he got to England, he didn't know where he was going, where he was living. He didn't have money even in his own pocket. So at least he had some friends still in England at that time, where he stayed with them, and the next day he was able to find him a job. And he worked washing dishes, you know, while he you know, got himself in a school, which is 4 years of college first year, and he paid for it. And he saved enough money to send even money to his parents, you know, to help them out. Because at that time they were living in one shack. It's one room for all these kids, a kitchen, living area, everything all in one room, basically. That's how they lived. So after he finished 4 years of college, he didn't want to go back, you know, to his country because there was nothing for him to do over there. So he won a scholarship to medical school in England. So he finished
his medical school. He did that based on his scholastic academic credentials, didn't he?
Right, yes. So, I mean, he didn't pay for his medical school at all. The British paid for it.
So he was a very brilliant man.
Yes,
he is. a very brilliant man.
He's a mathematician. I mean, all he wants to do is read books and just think. You know, he's not a big talker, but he's a big thinker.
mm-hmm. He's a big thinker.
Yeah, but he loves people, and he's very compassionate about
the environment. Now, he is a plastic surgeon. That's a very, he had to go back to school for a boarded specialty, and he took a residency in, was it New Jersey or New York?
After he finished medical school, they have 1 year of residency, they call it like internship. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, the British medical school gave him an option, either do the whole year in England or do like half of it in the United States. And he wanted to see another medical system, you know, some other system besides, you know, the socialized medicine they have in England. So he came to 6 months to do 6 months at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. And he did, you know, the 6 month, and he just loved the system. He just loved the freedom to be able to do, you know, anybody can go, anybody, you know, to get a treatment. And they're not limited, and they don't have to wait 6 months or so to see a physician like in England and the same system we have in Canada. So, I mean, if you wanted, you could go to the doctor. But he also felt like, you know, that in the United States, if you don't have the money, you really can't go, you know, to a specialties, you know. But he had this compassionate feeling. He just said, you know, even if people don't have the money, which is he did a lot of emergencies, people didn't have the money, we didn't force them to pay anything, you know, just write off the account. So, I
mean, he did reconstructive surgery for persons who had deforming injuries to their face.
Yes.
Very delicate hand surgery.
Yes.
You had told me about one particular young man who had his thumb severed.
In Florida, yes. Yes.
Yeah.
That was right
tell us about that case.
That was in Florida. After we got married in New Jersey, we moved to Florida. That was our first, you know, move because we didn't want to be in an area, and he didn't want to be in an area where there's too many plastic surgeons. He wanted to go to the rural area where there is a need for his specialty or where he could establish himself. And that's why we moved to Florida. And because he comes from the Caribbean, he loved the hot weather and the humidity. And so for me, it didn't matter because, you know, I felt like, you know, I'm his wife. I'll follow him no matter where he goes, you know. So we moved to Florida, and we were there like for 9 months, and that's when he was taking emergency calls, and which is he was on call 24 hours, and he was the only plastic surgeon at that town, which is Cocoa Beach. That's where it's on the east coast of Orlando, Florida. So he got called for this young man. Apparently, he was playing and he slid and he fell on the sliding doors, and the tracking for the sliding doors apparently was very sharp, and he fell on his hand, which is just totally totally amputated his thumb, and it was just hanging by the skin. And so when he came and he just looked at the kid, you know, if you take the entire thumb, he's got a useless hand because all you have is four fingers and nothing else to hang on to. And at that time, you know, it's just too complicated to transfer a toe to your thumb. And this is a young man, you know, you just don't want to destroy him like this. So he went ahead, and that's when he did all his reconstructive work in New Jersey College of Medicine. So he reattached everything. At the end, we didn't even know how to build the insurance company because the code was not even there, the CPT code. You know, to build the insurance, we didn't know how to use it.
This was a procedure was not routinely done. It was a very unique procedure.
Yes, yes.
And it required the attachment of all the structures of the thumb because everything had been severed.
Yes.
And if you're not a surgeon, you might not understand how very, very complicated that would be. And to reestablish both neurological connections so that, I mean, sewing together all those nerves and tendons and every single blood vessel in the thumb, I mean, it's very, very intensive work, very, very fine, delicate surgical work.
Especially with a young man, you know, because his tendons and nerves and everything else is so fine. It's not like an adult, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it took a lot of magnification, you know.
Yeah, they do that under magnifying scope, surgical
scope.
Now, so this young man now has the use of that thumb at this point.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was written in a local paper, and it was the first thumb replantation in the whole southeast United States. That was done by Jean.
So he's an extremely gifted surgeon, and we have lost his skills because the Texas Medical Board has revoked his license, have they not?
Yeah. Yes, I know.
And when did they do that?
They did that about 5 years ago. Yeah.
So for 5 years, we have not been having access to his surgical skills. Ken, I'd like to bring you on. You have been watching this case for a little while. Will you describe a little bit about what your group does down there and what your involvement has been?
Yes. I'm the director of the San Jacinto Constitutional Study Group that's in the Houston area. We meet in around Channelview, Texas, the suburb of Houston, and we meet like on the first and third Wednesdays of each month. We used to actually meet twice a week, and the gasoline started getting so high, you know, we broke it down to once a week, and I mean twice a week, and then, you know, it just got down to first and third Wednesdays of each month. We've been together, or the organization type thing has been together since about 95 to 96. So we've seen a lot of stuff come and go. There's been many, many people that's been come in that would say, you know, they have problems and what some of our options that we do. And over the years, we started finding out about all the corruption, of course, in the legal system. And nationwide and probably worldwide, where the more power someone gets, the more corrupt it seems like they do get. So we go along and look and see the best options to be able to stop some of the stuff. What's interesting is that most all of the laws that we found on the books and we started researching it, most all of them are in our favor, not the state, federal government, stuff like this. And that was what was really peculiar to us, is that if they really was really as corrupt as we're finding out, why didn't they just blatantly write the laws that we were subjects and we had to do this and we had to do this duty? And as we started more and more studying about the Constitution, we understood that they were restricted from doing that type of stuff. So they had to do it by deceit. They had to write it into a manner that would make someone believe that it had something to do with them. And because in the public fool system, you are told about how you spell your name, what words mean, do paragraphs, and they tell you all about the English language. And you start looking at that. Well, when you start reading the statutes, you believe that you're reading in a situation where, as you were in school, what a person is, and a lot of the different words, and until we started finding out that they actually changed the meaning of natural words, and it's called legalese. And then when we started finding out about this, we started finding out that the laws actually didn't occur or really apply to us. And it was these entities. I mean, the snowball just kept getting bigger and bigger as we started looking at it. And it was a very interesting journey through the Constitution.
Now, you're talking about the U.S. Constitution or the Texas Constitution?
Actually, we started off with the U.S. Constitution. There's a black man named Norris Austin. He's a teacher. And he started back in the 90s teaching people about the U.S. Constitution. And we've actually got a video of him that lasts 9 hours long talking about the actual U.S. Constitution. And he is a what you call an expert on the thing. And we go through it sentence by sentence and that type of situation. And here's the main issue about the U.S. Constitution. If you look at Article 1, Section 1, and you see where it says, all legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in a Congress of the United States, which shall consist of a Senate and a House of Representatives. And it sounds pretty, you know, benign that all the powers are in the Congress and you know, they do the legislative, so you think about the separation of the branches. But when you break down the sentence and you see that the word all is at the beginning, which means there is no other legislative powers other than in Congress, but the main two words in that sentence is herein granted. The all legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in the Congress of the United States. Well, if it's not herein, then it is not actually granted by the delegation of the Constitution. So when you go through the Constitution, you start finding out what their duties are, like Article 1, Section 8, which shows all of the things that they can do. And then you start looking at what they have done. You start finding out that they have took their powers that are delegated to the possessions in the District of Columbia and the possessions of the United States Corporation type thing. They have different powers to rule the possessions. Like, you know, they created this stuff. It's like the creator and the created. The created cannot tell the creator what to do. So when the United States creates Puerto Rico and Virgin Islands and Guam and all these places like this as part of itself, they get to tell them stuff to do that they really don't have the delegated authority in the Constitution to tell somebody that's within the 50 states what to do.
Well, so, let's get back to Jacques' case. You have been to court twice in regards to his situation?
Yes, I was there, I believe it was March the 25th, and I got an email from him saying he was fixing to have a hearing, and I really didn't know that much about what was really going on, and so I went up there just to watch, and I was just absolutely, I just could not believe what I actually saw that was there, and there was the bank attorneys there complaining about a response that Jacques had sent them. I believe it had to do with something about the foreclosure or something like this. Well, the bank had sent Jacques, I believe, some kind of document, and then Jacques answered the document to them. Well, the bank goes along and sends and files this response into the court, and then they do a show cause hearing wanting to know whether or not that response violated the order that Judge Hughes had put out back. Oh gosh, it was a, let's see, what was the date on that thing?
2006.
Yeah, it was actually, it says July the 19th, 2006. So you think about it, that's like 3 years ago, this order, and all of a sudden, in 3 years ago, they can go along there and take an order and then throw you in jail for it. Well, when you start looking at the order of it, it's absolutely, you know, it just don't make any sense at all, like where this authority comes from. Because he has ordered Jacques not to file any documents in any state or federal court that he cannot, if he needs to sue anybody, he can't do it without the judge's permission. And that if he does get sued by any other people, that he's forbidden to even put a counterclaim into it, that he can only defend the case himself without going to jail or, you know, being in contempt or something like this. I mean, I've just never seen any such thing ever done.
Now, is it, I understand that he is currently being held and has been held in solitary confinement, and that he was kept out of contact with his wife. Is that true, Sue?
Yes, correct.
How long has he been in jail, and how long has it been you've not been able to talk to him?
Since the first week of April. That's the last time we got to talk to him. The first week he was with the general public, and I think after 1 week, that's when he got yanked out of the general public, thrown in total isolation without any reason, you know, without telling him anything. It took us a while to figure it out. Basically, they came up with this reason saying because his name is on the domestic terrorist list. Where they come up with that list, I have no earthly idea. And why is this? And that. So because of that reason, he only allowed one call per month, and they only give him, I don't know, so many 5 pages to write on. And, of course, you know, everything has been copied and screened, everything, you know, in and out, you know. And since a month ago, he developed a surgical problem that he needs surgical, you know, medical care, and he's not allowed to get that.
So the judge told him he wasn't allowed to get medical care?
Correct, yes.
Is that true, Ken?
Yes, that's what I actually heard. Yes, he actually said that when he gets out of this furlough that he's fixing to go out to, that if he was to go and actually see a medical doctor while this week that he's supposed to be out, that he will be in trouble, but he didn't specify the trouble he would be in. He was told that...
So he's actually ordered by the judge not to seek independent medical care of for a medical concern that he had.
Right. Now, just think about it, that Jock gets on the car and then has a car wreck, an ambulance comes up, and by what the judge stated, that if he was to be took to a hospital or something like that, then he could be held in contempt for actually seeing a medical doctor without the permission of the judge. Think about that.
Which is, he did ask for permission to be seen by medical physician, and the judge refused.
Right, yeah, if he's conscious.
Yeah.
And his physical condition when you saw him in the courtroom, Ken?
He had seemed like he'd lost quite a bit of weight, in which he don't really have that much weight to lose. And he looked really depressed, as you would say. I mean, like, who wouldn't be? But he seemed like he was, he did grin and wave at me, but of course no one could let us talk or anything like that. It was like 5 or 6 marshals in there. All the U.S. marshals were laughing about something. They were all happy guys. And it was, I think they let him talk to this attorney, his medical advisor attorney, probably about maybe 2 to 4 minutes or something like this.
Is that attorney Jeff Grass?
Yes, yes, that's who that is.
Attorney Jeff Grass from Austin, Texas.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
But what was interesting about the thing is that after the hearing, I get a letter from Jock telling me that he had contacted Judge Hughes 2 weeks before about, you know, having a medical problem looked at, and he needed a hearing to tell about the, you know, his medical problem. And he said, it's been 2 weeks since I've requested the hearing, and he still hasn't got the hearing. And this letter I got was the day, and it was, you know, addressed the day before the hearing, and which means that Jock didn't even know the hearing was even going to be taking place until probably the day that they come and got him on the thing. So he, by this letter I see, he had no notice of the hearing at all, him, that Jock did.
So he wasn't able to prepare his statements or talk to his attorney or speak to his wife about his concerns for his medical condition?
No.
Sue, how did you find his physical appearance when you saw him in court?
Oh, I wasn't there.
No,
oh,
I,
okay.
Just me and youngest son was the only one who was actually there.
Oh, okay, okay.
And Shirley Potts, I believe.
Shirley Pigott.
Mm-hmm. I guess
was there, was present, and of course Jeff Grass was also present. Now the Texas Constitution states that all criminal prosecutions of the accused should have a speedy public trial by an impartial jury, and he shall have the right to demand the nature and cause of the accusation against him and have a copy thereof. He shall not be compelled to give evidence against himself and shall have the right of being heard by himself or counsel or both, shall be confronted by witnesses against him, shall have compulsory process for obtaining witnesses in his favor, except that when the witness resides out of state and the offense charged is a violation of any of the antitrust laws of the state. The defendant should have the right to produce and have evidence admitted by deposition under the rules and laws as the legislature may hereafter provide, and no person shall be held to answer for a criminal offense unless an indictment of a grand jury, except in cases where the punishment is by fine or imprisonment, otherwise than in a penitentiary, in cases of impeachment, in cases rising from the Army or Navy, or in the militia, when in actual service, time of war, or public danger. So in other words, the accused has a right to know what they're accused of. They have a right to speedy trial. They have a right to provide evidence in court of law. From your perspective, Ken, has this part of the Texas Constitution been abided by in this case?
No, it hasn't. But the actual main section of the Bill of Rights is Section 29. That is actually where people don't understand is that the Bill of Rights has accepted everything that is not in the Texas Constitution.
By this, you mean the Texas Bill of Rights or the U.S.?
Yes.
The Texas Constitution.
Do you have that there in front of you, Section 29, Article 1?
I have the Bill of Rights in front of me at this moment.
Yeah, the Bill of Rights on Section 29.
Okay. To guard against transgressions of higher powers herein delegated. Okay. Yeah.
Yes, that's it.
The Texas Constitution comes across the very first sentence is all political power is inherent in the people, and all free governments are founded on their authority and instituted for their benefit. And that's directly from the Texas Constitution.
Yeah,
we do have a caller on the line. I'd like to see who this person is and what they would like to talk to us about. Hello. Hello, you're on the line, on the air. Are you there?
Hi there.
And who may we be talking to here?
Hi, my name's Charity, and I'm deaf, and I am in Virginia, and I'm listening to you through a sign language interpreter.
Well, that's wonderful. And you have an interest in this case or in this issue?
I'm finding it interesting, but what I'm having a hard time following is what exactly is this the doctor being imprisoned for?
That is what we don't understand. he has not been actually indicted or charged with any crime at this point. He is being held for contempt of court.
Civil contempt.
Yes. Can you explain, Ken?
Well, there's two types of contempt. There actually is civil and there's actually criminal. And Judge Hughes will not specify which, you know, that is. In fact, he hasn't even said the word contempt in any of the hearings that I've been to. He just says that I don't believe, Jock, that you've learned your lesson, and I believe that we're going to have the marshals take you into custody. I mean, this is the type of language that Judge Hughes uses. It's all vague about everything that's going on. You know, it's the order that you would see that they specified under his court case. Now, think about a court case. If you would tell anybody that's going to file a civil case in a federal court and be the plaintiff, and then and you see a sign on the door that says, "Be it warned, as the plaintiff of this thing, you may be held in contempt if the judge doesn't like you and be put in and incarcerated for a time that the judge will designate." Now, how many people would file a civil suit in federal court if they could see that sign? This is the type of thing that's been happening to Jock, is that he was a plaintiff of a civil matter, and this judge now has thrown him in jail for violating his order and did not specify how he could have possibly violated an order. It was just absolutely ridiculous. You know, I can't find no reasoning for it other than the judge does not like Jock.
So we have concerns as to whether or not Jock really understands, or any of us understand, what it is the judge really wants him to do, and why exactly, the exact reason for this incarceration. So this is a pretrial detention that has been going on for a very long period of time, sometimes in solitary confinement, and without access to medical care, and without any ability of us to understand how we can legally address it.
Correct.
Right. Well, the first hearing that I witnessed back in March, I went along and actually found a place in the Fifth Circuit where you could actually file a complaint against a federal judge, and I actually did that process onto it. And I now have just got it in the mail yesterday. It says this letter is to acknowledge that your complaint of misconduct against the United States District Judge Lynn H. Hughes has been assigned the following docket number, 05-09-90113. And it says you will be advised by mail of the chief judge action on your complaint. I mean, I really don't expect much, but since I've got that and I've got a docket number, I'm fixing to send another complaint and attach that docket number to it so that they can hear both about both hearings that I actually witnessed onto it. It just seems like these people are getting to a situation where there's nobody overseeing what's going on, and I don't have too much confidence that the Fifth Circuit is going to do anything. I found a document where there's been something like, for the last 10 years, there's been like 8,000 complaints against federal judges, and I believe 7 of them actually got sanctioned the judges for their actions out of 8,000. So, you know, that tells you right there that they don't really act too much on somebody's complaint.
Now, because he's in pretrial detention, he has a right to be assisted promptly by legal counsel. He has a right to request legal aid. He has a right to have his validity of his detention determined by way of habeas corpus or other means. He has a right to be visited and correspond with members of his family, and reasonable conditions and restrictions as specified by law. And the pretrial detention is subject to judicial review. We are basically feeling that this particular case needs to have judicial review. Did that answer your question, Charity? Are you still on the line, Charity?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, I guess you made it as clear as possible, but how long is he going to be in jail?
We don't know.
We have no idea. And the problem is there's no legal recourse to find out how long.
As far as I can tell by the what's happened in the past, civil contempt can be either 6 months or a year, but you know, we haven't heard that it actually is contempt he's being held for. So we don't know if he hasn't been sentenced. He hasn't had a hearing about it. I believe that Jock even told me that in one of his letters that he did ask for the ability to purge himself of contempt, and that the judge ignored him and just said, well, you're going to prison. And see, that's not – this allocution – is supposed to be in a situation that if you are held in contempt, there's supposed to be a remedy to it, and that they're supposed to give you a remedy. Like if you've done something and held in contempt, as long as you agree that you won't do that anymore or in that time, there is no reason to hold you in there again, because it doesn't supposed to be about punishment. It's supposed to be – you know, to make you follow their dictates and stuff like this. But as long as you follow it, then they don't have a problem. I've even sent the documents from the fictitious litigants, webs, you know, the sites and everything about people that the judges determined to be people who file suits that have no merit and things like this. Even in the Fifth Circuit, it definitely specifies there that there is no jailable offense to be a fictitious litigant. The only thing that they can do by their own law is to fine them, you know, like make them pay attorney's fees or court fees or something like that for filing a suit that has no merit. But I've got a case where even in the Fifth Circuit where a guy filed 500 court cases, 500, paid filing fees and stuff like that for all 500, and the only thing they could do to this guy was to make him pay attorney's fees. They could not put him in jail for filing 500 cases. So here's Judge Hughes violating the Fifth Circuit, of which is his supposedly his boss. And, you know, it seems like he just does whatever he wants to do. It doesn't matter what the president is about what does happen in certain situations. He just doesn't like Jock, and he's going to punish him because he's got the ability to do it. Now, maybe this review board will look at it and see that he don't have no leg to stand on and do it. I've even got a Houston, found out from the Houston Chronicle, or years back, that Lynn Hughes has been accused of actually changing transcripts in his court, telling the court reporter that, no, that's not what that said. It said this instead, and had her to rewrite some of his testimony to make him look better.
Now, this case kind of hinges on something having to do with a bank, and the judge said something in the last transcript about selling Jock's house. What is that about?
Is that a question for me?
Yeah, right.
Anyone who can answer it. Go ahead, Sue.
Well, basically, in the state of Texas, that you can take someone's home to satisfy a judgment. And what the bank had is basically a judgment against Jacques. And because of the judgment and because of the U.S. bank, they claiming they had the note, which is they could not produce in court, you know, the promissory note. They could not produce. All they said to the judge, yeah, we do have it. But Jacques kept insisting on, okay, produce it, you know, let me see it. They could not. And basically the judge in the state court saying, yeah, that's good enough. As long as they have it, that's good enough. So they gave them a judgment against Jacques. And basically that, if there was any note, got converted to basically a judgment. So when Jacques filed this lawsuit in a federal case, basically to force them to produce the note, the judge didn't want to hear it, and all he did is basically turn the whole case against Jacques and dismiss his case and awarded them basically the house and, you know, plus $40,000 of legal fees and stuff like that. And at the same time, he went ahead and signed an order preventing Jacques from filing anything and corresponding to anybody without the judge's permission.
So in other words, they're taking his house without having the due process, with having the documentation that proves that they
correct.
Have a legal right to.
Correct.
And Jacques, of course, is wanting to protect his property rights, and so therefore he filed a civil suit against the bank saying, you can't take my house without proof of the judgment.
Right. But I think the judge didn't want to hear that, and he just dismissed his case and granted the countersuit to the bank, which is through their attorney, you know, there's whatever they ask for, you know. And even I've been in one time in a court where the judge was directing the attorney to what to do, and he was telling him, go ahead and write this and I'll sign it, you know, right in front of everybody. So he was leading, you know, the attorney for the bank.
So we have concerns for proper due process in this court, is really what it amounts to. And we do have concerns about the human rights of Jacques himself, as he is being held for considerable time here, out of contact with his family, out of contact with those who can assure his medical safety. And so that is what we have concerns about. Do you have anything to add there, Ken?
Well, like I say, he was definitely had his civil rights violated. The Title 42 doesn't allow that type of action to be done to anybody, even someone that is a naturalized citizen or something like this. They don't have any authority to do it. And that's where this thing about herein granted is actually coming from. It just looks like the court system is, running amok, I would call it, because there's a lot of stuff that's going on that there's no oversight for it. And now whether or not this complaint system that's in there is going to be able to do something, I have no idea. I mean, Judge Hughes, since he was so involved in this case, he should have recused himself and sent it to another judge, actually, is what he should have done, and put that upon another federal judge to litigate it, because it's blatant that he doesn't like Jock at all. And if he has an opportunity to punish him, that seems like that's what he wants to do. I mean, he says in open court that he doesn't believe Jock is a doctor. So, I mean, you know, he's making a medical claim about him not being a medical doctor. He wants Jock to pay, you know, this attorney fees and stuff like this, but he wants Jock to get a job like at Jack in the Box or Walmart or something like this and pay the judge half of whatever he gets. And instead of him actually helping Jock get his medical license back so he would have the ability to pay him, then he seems like to be doing everything in his power to restrict Jock from paying any obligations that he might have. And then you look into it is that he really doesn't want the money. He just wants to harm Jock, because Jock is a very strong-willed person that he doesn't show the fear like a lot of people do in court, and he doesn't give them the respect that they expect everyone to bow down and just think that there's somebody above the law. And Jock doesn't really give him that attitude, and he's finding out that, you know, some people have the power to harm you, even though they don't have the authority to do it.
Well, it looks like we have another caller on the line. I'd like to bring that person in. Hello. You calling from Washington, D.C.? Hello? Hello, you're on the air. I have someone on Washington, D.C. phone number, I think. Doesn't seem like they're coming on with us. Maybe they don't realize they're on.
Probably a government agent that accidentally hit the one and didn't know that he didn't supposed to do that.
No, I have many, many of my attorneys in my group. They're from Washington.
So okay.
That might be a very friendly call. We are concerned, of course, of his essential rights, both from the UN perspective of the rights of human dignity. The UN principles, essential principles, include, and I'll just go over the first three very important principles. All human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. Human rights derive from the inherent dignity of the human person. All persons deprived of their liberty shall be treated at all times with humanity and with respect for the inherent dignity of the human person. And in the UN covenants, people are not supposed to be subjected to cruel or inhumane or degrading treatment and punishment. It does seem that there is a level of aspect of degrading Jock as a doctor, as a person, by the actions of the judge here.
Could I bring one point?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, one thing that we didn't tell you about, the reason that Jock was the way he was at this beginning, this March 25th hearing, is that before all this March 25th, that the judge had put him in jail before for, I don't know, a few days or whatever. And Jock told me out in the hall that at that time, he actually had Jock stripped down naked, put in a cell that's concrete and metal only, with no pillow, no covering whatsoever, and was left in the cell for 3 days before anyone ever gave him any clothing. So, and this is the guy that he was in front of on this March 25th hearing, and this is what this judge had done to him. He used the excuse that he thought that Jock might hurt himself. So what we're going to do is take everything away from you that you can't hurt yourself with. And they left him in a cell for 3 days with nothing at all.
And that is considered degrading in treatment. Forced nakedness is definitely considered degrading treatment.
Especially a doctor, of anybody, a doctor.
Yeah.
It's beyond me.
It was meant to put him in his place, so to speak. Prisoners are, by the UN convention, are supposed to be informed of their alleged offense and having opportunity to present a proper defense. And there are some questions as to whether that has happened in this case.
Absolutely. There is no evidence that I can see since this March 25th has actually been put in, showing anything that Jock has done that would warrant what they're doing to him.
And he has not been charged with any offense.
Not that I can find
officially. It's being held in pre-trial detention.
And not charged with a crime, and there's nothing in the docket that shows that any complaint has actually been done other than this show of cause hearing on March the 25th about whether or not this communication that he sent the bank had violated the judge's order, which you can, if you look at the judge's order, it could not have done that.
And according to the UN Convention, untried prisoners are generally allowed visits from their own doctor or dentist. Has it been allowed to have that happen, Sue?
No.
What is your understanding about his medical condition?
Well, I know he has a hernia, and I don't know what is the other problem. I guess he's a very private person. A lot of things about his health issue, he doesn't discuss it with me. So, I mean, even when we were living together, I didn't know a lot about his health problems. You know, he treated himself, I guess, because he's a doctor, so he could treat himself. But he never had any surgery in the past. And, I know he takes medication for his heart, but...
Is he getting his heart medication
No.
So he's not getting his heart medication he had been previously on?
No. No, he's not taking any heart medication, or he also has a bladder problem. There's no medication been provided for him while he's in there.
So he's not getting his the medication that he was routinely on, he's not receiving.
Right. Correct, yes.
Did he get any visits from the United Nations?
I don't think so. He hasn't mentioned anything.
From the Red Cross?
No.
From any humanitarian agency while he was in
I don't know. He didn't mention anything in his letters, because the only communication we have is letters, you know, mm-hmm. he sent out. And all he's been asking for, please get me somebody, please get me somebody. This judge is not listening. This judge is not, you know, giving me the chance to explain anything. Or in his mind, you know, he doesn't understand. And it did happen many times in the past where I told him, you know, please, you know, whatever you do, just go ahead and ask for permission. But in his mind, he just said, what am I, a slave? Because I feel like I'm being treated like a slave. So everything I do, I have to get a permission. And he just said, the only thing left for me is I have to ask permission to go to the bathroom, you know, because he's worried and afraid how this judge is going to react. And, of course, you know, the attorney for the bank, he's been watching Jock, you know, 24 hours a day. And I don't know. I mean, in my feeling, they tried to get him in trouble. And they just run to the judge immediately, whether it's his fault or someone else's fault, and complain to the judge. And the judge is not listening to Jacques' side. He's only listening to one side only. And I don't know what's the motive behind it. I have no clue, no idea why all these things happening, you know, to Jacques. Why?
Well, how much is this property worth that they are wanting to sell, that the bank believes that they can sell and take the assets of? How much is it worth?
Which property?
The house and...
The house we were living in?
Whatever property it is that's under...
Well, the house that we were living in, it was over $1 million. The value, over $1 million. It's 1.2 something.
Mm-hmm.
And the mortgage, that was only 275. And they took that. And they're still coming back after, you know, the attorney's fee, which is, what, 20,000, I think.
And then when they went to sell that over $1 million property, they weren't able to do so because they didn't actually truly have the paperwork that proved that they had the right to sell it.
I think they sold it already.
Oh, they did sell it.
Yeah, they did sell it. That was back in, 2007, somewhere there. Yeah, they already sold it.
And was this in relationship to an IRS debt to the IRS?
Which one? The house?
That sale of the house.
No. This is just for the bank to take it over. That's for the bank, basically, because they're claiming they have the note.
Yeah,
and,
you know, when they take your medical license away from you, it's hard to keep up a lot of bills onto it.
So
I was gonna let you, in the hearing that I was there, the bankers were complaining that they couldn't get a constable or U.S. Marshals to do what they needed to sell some property. I don't know if it was in Dallas or where. And the judge seemed like he was confused that they couldn't get a U.S. Marshal to do something for him. So they're apparently having a problem with some of the law enforcement officials doing some kind of foreclosure. So I don't know what that's about.
Now, you did file a complaint to a higher authority again?
Yes, I sent it to the Fifth Circuit. There's a complaint system for the United States Court of Appeals in the Fifth Circuit. And like I say, I read that letter I just got yesterday from the clerk of the Fifth Circuit stating that my complaint has been docketed and to be heard. I don't know when, but hopefully I'm going to send a supplement to it over this last hearing to see if that maybe the supplement will have something to do with it. I mean, it's, you know...
Well, we only have 1 minute remaining here, so we're going to have to get off. But this has been a very fascinating discussion. And this is Dr. Jeanette Parker coming to you live from Lawrence, Kansas. This is Medical Whistleblower, and we are an advocacy group in regards to problems within the medical community, abuse and neglect of patients, medical fraud, and human rights violations. I thank you all for listening to us today. I hope you will join us again. We do go live again at 5 p.m. Central Time on Saturday, And we will have a special show on Wednesday at noon. And join us for those two shows. And I thank you all for listening.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for being on our show. Thank you.
Thank you.